Welcome to the Dialogue on War and Peace for Unitarian Universalists. I'm your host, Kathy Partridge, and I'll be walking with you through an hour of dialogue among three prominent peace activists and scholars. I'd like to welcome Sharon Welch, provost at Mead Lombard Theological School, the author of After Empire, The Art and Ethos of Enduring Peace, and the forthcoming book, Real Security, Real Peace, The Challenges of Global Citizenship. Sharon Welch is also chair of the U.S. Steering Committee of Global Action to Prevent War. Welcome, Sharon Welch.
Thank you.
Great. And with us also on the phones is Paul Razor, UU theologian and author of Faith Without Certainty, Liberal Theology in the 21st Century. His article, Prophetic Nonviolence Towards a Unitarian Universalist Theology of War and Peace, appears in the spring 2008 issue of the UU World. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Great. And finally in the studio with me, Ira Chernas, professor of religious studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder, where he's been teaching courses on religion and nonviolence for over 15 years. He's the author of American Nonviolence, The History of an Idea, as well as many books and articles on U.S. national security policy. Welcome, Ira Chernas.
Thank you very much.
Great. Well, so glad to be doing this with you today and giving Unitarian Universalists a chance to understand better about the issues around war and peace. Sharon Welch, can you set the stage for us by telling us what is the CSAI? What does that stand for and what does this all mean?
Well, the Congregational Study Action issue is something that's voted on in the past every year at the General Assembly. And it's an attempt for Unitarian Universalists to articulate their stance on major policy issues. And the stance that's taken is to be grounded theologically and ethically in the best of Unitarian Universalist traditions, and then serves as guidance both for people who are in the Washington Advocacy Office when they're working with members of Congress, as well as reflecting the wisdom of congregations and what they think is most important in terms of some of the political issues that we need to be grappling with out of our faith tradition. What is different about this particular issue is that the study action issue that was adopted in 2006 was put in a multi-year process. Rather than there being a new issue coming up every year, we decided that we would spend 4 years for congregations studying this particular issue. And the question that was posed on the surface seems quite simple. It's, should the Unitarian Universalist Association reject the use of any and all kinds of violence and war and adopt a principle of seeking just peace through nonviolent means? Now, while some people had interpreted this as a call for a debate between just war and those who are committed to nonviolence, those of us who are on the core planning team for this study action issue have seen things quite differently. We were thinking that the exploration of war and peace should itself be an exercise in peacemaking. And so we have tried to frame the whole study of the issue in a way where we really do learn to understand better the different perspectives that people hold, and that we follow really some of the salient lessons that we've all learned from those who are experts in conflict transformation, that quite often whenever you have seemingly polarized opposite points of view, if you listen deeply, you'll find that there are quite often third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh alternatives. Sometimes there are more areas of genuine agreement than there are disagreement, and even where there are areas of fundamental disagreement, it's possible to really listen to those with rigor and honesty and respect. And that's been the goal of the process that we've tried to put in place.
Great. Thank you, Sharon Welch, for sharing that. And what role do the Unitarian Universalist congregations play in this process?
The congregations are asked to give feedback on several issues. One, what they think the content of the resolution should be, but secondly, and I think this is even more importantly, the ways in which living out their particular understandings of how we should respond to the challenges of war and peace, how that affects their congregational life and their particular settings. So we're looking both for feedback on an issue in terms of a declaration as well as a spectrum of ways that congregations live faithfully.
And our congregations are being challenged to not avoid the hard question of just war and pacifism. Paul Raiser, you wrote an article in the UU World, and can you elaborate a bit on your perspective?
Sure. Thanks very much, and Sharon, thanks for that excellent introduction to the process. The study action issue invites us as a denomination to adopt or to contemplate adopting a specific policy around issues of war and peace, as well as the other procedural benefits that Sharon talked about. And it frames this kind of as an invitation in terms of the just war tradition on the one hand and nonviolence on the other hand, as Sharon read the question. Now, historically, Unitarian Universalists have largely followed the just war approach on these kinds of issues, although certainly nonviolence and pacifism have always had a strong following among us. And I think Sharon is correct that this should not be seen as a debate between the two. I mean, there is a way to read the study action issue as asking us if we want to continue our traditional emphasis on just war, or whether, in fact, we want to take a stronger stance in favor of nonviolence. And we may want to do that, but we certainly don't want to let this fall into a kind of either-or issue. And my own hope is that we can avoid the kinds of divisions that we've sometimes fallen into in the past. My own approach actually tries to blend the two traditions or to find commonalities between them. And I start myself with a fundamental commitment to nonviolence, but for me, this has to be an engaged nonviolence, not what we might call a passive nonviolence withdrawal. And so I think two fundamental things are required to make the nonviolence commitment work. The first is to continue the prophetic dimension of our liberal religious tradition by bringing moral judgment, what I've called prophetic critique, to bear on our government's military practices. And this is where the just war theory can help. We can use its criteria, just cause, last resort, proportionality, and so on, for the purpose of evaluating the government's response. Now, I realize that the just war theory has often been used in the past to justify violence rather than to restrict it, but I think it can be used and really should be used much more restrictively than it has been. And besides, the just war theory is simply one tool for this purpose. And I think that for our own denominational discernment, that we need to pay attention to our own resources, the resources of our own tradition for grounding this kind of critique, and so that whatever approach we take to war in general or to particular wars should at least reflect our deepest religious values. And I've tried to suggest in the article about how that might work in certain cases. And the second point that I would want to make about engaged nonviolence is that it's not enough simply to take a strong moral stance or to critique particular wars, although I think we do need to do that. But we also need to be engaged in the active work of peacemaking. And Sharon has mentioned how one of the hopes of this process is that congregations can engage in this as they go through the process. And on a larger scale, we need to be practicing and encouraging nonviolent conflict resolution at the personal level, congregational level, and even at the international level, and building the kinds of international institutional structures and just communities where this sort of thing can work well.
Paul Raiser, we have recently seen Unitarian Universalist President Bill Sinkford making pastoral statements and letters and so forth about the war. Can you maybe set those briefly in the context of the ideas that you raise in your UU World article?
Yeah, I think that the kind of statements that Bill is making and the kind of statements that anyone from our tradition may want to make are, in fact, exactly what we ought to be doing, to be applying our religious values to the particular issues that have come up in the context of the war in Iraq, for example, as well as perhaps on more general policies. So I think that, my own suggestion would be that we try to identify the specific theological values that we hold most dear, the inherent worth and dignity of all persons, for example, or love as a primary value, justice, the interconnectedness of all persons, and so on. and to ask whether war or particular war furthers these values or, in fact, interferes with them. And so I think statements from the president or from any of us who speak from this perspective can and should ask those kinds of questions.
Sharon Welch, as you laid out the study action issue, what are your thoughts as Paul Raiser is speaking?
Well, one of the things I think is important is Paul is describing the way Unitarian Universalist, as well as many religious traditions, have rich histories that they can pull on and draw on as we look at these issues. And I think we can look back at different times when there have been cogent critiques of war, as well as ground ourselves in those who have made really bold statements in trying to make it possible to move for a world without war. I think going back to, say, Erasmus in the 16th century and his eloquent critiques of war between the Christian princes and against with the Christian princes against the Turks, and then finding in Erasmus not only a critique of war but also providing the grounding for the kind of thinking that we later find in Immanuel Kant of the idea of the need for a rule of law between nations, and seeing gradually how with the League of Nations and then the United Nations that we are actually beginning to try to put some of these alternatives into place. And as we do so, being propelled, and again, as Paul was saying, not only by political convictions, but by theological and ethical ones as well.
Well, let's turn to the question, the issue of the principled nonviolence. Ira Chernus, we've invited you. You've spoken with UU audiences before. What would you share on the idea of principled nonviolence as a way for UUs to engage in the world?
I think the most important thing to recognize to begin with is that so often nonviolence is understood as merely refraining from violence. I call it the don't hit rule. But the nonviolence tradition that we associate with Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King is a much more active, engaged, and positive tradition. And many people may know this, but I think it's always important to reinforce this very central idea that nonviolence means a whole set of positive values that fit actually very well with the basic principles of Unitarian Universalism. One principle speaks of the goal of a world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. And the nonviolence tradition of Gandhi and King starts from the premise that the world is indeed a single community. And as another UU principle puts it, that we're part of an interdependent web of all existence. And the nonviolence tradition is based on this premise, this assumption that because we're all interdependent, none of us can ever be at peace until everyone has liberty and justice. So that nonviolence means very actively pursuing justice and liberty and equity for all. And it means resisting injustice, resisting it very strenuously wherever we find it. Another UU principle that I think contains a great insight speaks of justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, which implies, as the nonviolence tradition has always insisted on, that when we resist injustice and when we resist inequity, we must at the same time be extending compassion to everyone. That means even to those who are perpetrating the injustice, even those who are blocking the way to equity, we have to have compassion for them too, which means that we cannot intend to do any harm to them, no matter how much harm they're doing to other people. That means that we don't divide the world into the bad guys who have to be defeated and the good guys who have to be victorious, because we're all parts of a single interdependent web. So I think the essence of nonviolence, again, is a very active resistance of injustice, an effort to create more justice and equity by preserving and enhancing the interdependent web of life. But if we intentionally set out to kill or maim anyone, no matter how bad their deeds, we are killing and maiming that interdependent web of all life. And this obviously connects with one other UU principle, the respect for the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Because when we respect everyone and recognize their dignity, and when we have compassion for all, because we recognize that they're all part of the interdependent web of life, then it just seems obvious that we cannot set out to kill or maim people. How can you respect someone's inherent worth and dignity and yet at the same time have an intentional plan to kill them, maim them, harm them? And so I agree with Paul, certainly, that we need to be making a prophetic critique of violence and actively working for peacemaking. It just seems to me that the nonviolence tradition of Gandhi and King gives us the most effective way to do that and to pursue all of these principles of Unitarian Universalism that I've just mentioned.
Ira Chernis, the UU community is very proud of our heritage of having participated in the civil rights movement. Yet the idea of being a nonviolence advocating denomination is certainly, I think we'd have to say, controversial for UUs. What do you think the legacy of Martin Luther King might suggest for UUs who felt very close to King today? What about his views in this debate?
I think it suggests all the principles that I've just been talking about work together best when we commit ourselves to nonviolence. Again, I keep repeating this because it's so important. Nonviolence not as a passive stance, not as merely refraining from violence, but nonviolence as the most effective way to pursue justice and equity while retaining our ideal of preserving the interdependent web of all life. When you read Dr. King's sermons and speeches, he was talking about that every day and recognizing that it's also the most practical way, the most effective way to gain justice and equity for all people. So it's not a matter of a trade-off, say, well, if we want to be more idealistic, we have to lose the practical benefits. No, to the contrary, the most practical way to preserve justice and peace over the long run is to pursue it nonviolently.
Well, Paul Raiser, you mentioned just a minute ago, and certainly in your article, a commitment or interest in nonviolence, yet have some pragmatic questions, perhaps, that we see you raising?
Well, yes, and Ira's certainly raising those. I mean, I really appreciate Ira's pointing out that there's a long tradition of nonviolence, whether we call it a philosophical tradition or a political tradition, that's not necessarily, or certainly not only, grounded in religious principles and so on, and I appreciate the way he's attempting to link up the longer tradition of nonviolence with our own theological values. And there are different ways of articulating or approaching nonviolence, and certainly the Gandhi and King tradition is one, and that's a very rich tradition because it uses nonviolent, or what they often called nonviolent resistance, as a technique, if you will, for political and social change, as well as a way to respond to war itself and so on. So I think that's a very helpful thing to point out.
Sharon Welch, let's bring you into the conversation as well on your thoughts of this conversation around nonviolence and just war theory.
Right. One of the things I think is very important, and it's something that we on the core team have wanted to bring to the forefront, is that traditions both of just war and traditions of commitment to nonviolence are evolving traditions. They have long histories. Reverend Frank Carpenter, who's on a member of our core team, makes the point, for example, that one of the reasons why, as Unitarian Universalists, there hasn't been a set response to war, but you can chart the way the particular responses that have emerged have reflected their context. And one of the things that I want to highlight is something that's happening that is particular to our context and reflects a very interesting development, both within those committed to nonviolence and those committed to just war. And I think it's something that we need to think about seriously Whether everyone agrees with these changes is probably highly unlikely, but I think it's important to be aware of what they are. The first change is a shift that's beginning to emerge within people who have in the past seen themselves as opposed to the use of violence in any form whatsoever. And there's a convergence of some, the Friends Committee for National Legislation, some Mennonites, some Catholic peacemakers, for example, with people who have taken a more liberal internationalist approach. And this is specifically in regard to what is called the responsibility to protect. Basically, the issue, quite simply, is whenever a government either cannot or will not protect its citizens from genocide, crimes against humanity, or natural disasters, does the international community have a responsibility to intervene? And there is both a growing consensus that we do have a responsibility to intervene, and then the issue becomes what are the most effective means of intervention. And what is happening here, which I think is very thought-provoking, is matching the consensus that there is a responsibility to intervene, there's a sense that the most effective interventions have three different kinds of foci, all right, that they differ. For example, so you find people talking about the importance of peacekeeping, peacemaking, and peacebuilding. And peacekeeping is simply stopping violence through the containment and then demobilization of military forces. Peacemaking is the process of bringing hostile parties to agreement, and peace building is creating the long-term structures that actually address the structural violence, the injustice, the economic exploitation, the racial exploitation that leads to violent conflicts. And what's happening here is an interesting morph on the one side from just war traditions, because while the criteria for intervention follow the just war conventions, and while there's also a sense of putting conditions on the use of violence, also from the just war, there's a recognition that while violence may at times play a key role in stopping genocide, for example, General Dallaire, say the Canadian general who said in Rwanda, if he would have had 1,500 troops, he could have stopped the genocide. Or people now saying the need for armed peacekeepers or armed police forces in Darfur. There's a recognition, though, that these forces, while they may be able to stop the violence, can neither produce security nor sustainable peace. Right, so that, in a sense, there's a policing function that, while essential, is never sufficient. And at that point, there's the need for the more systemic and long-term work of peace building and peacemaking. And these lead to such complex issues of truth and reconciliation commissions and restorative justice and the reintegration of former combatants, which involves far more than just giving people jobs since they're no longer employed as soldiers, but also the kind of spiritual and social and cultural reintegration once a society has been destroyed by conflict. Now, a second development, which is equally interesting, and this is coming within strictly the just war tradition, is I think it's so fascinating that we now find that from within the military, many people are beginning to realize something that advocates of nonviolence, like IRA, have known for a long time, that quite often nonviolence is far more effective than violence. And in fact, extreme violence is inevitably counterproductive. The recent Army and Marine Corps field manual, for example, states some representative paradoxes of counterinsurgency. And I want to just read a few. The first one, the more you protect your force, the less secure you are. The more force is used, the less effective it is. And it says the best weapons for counterinsurgency do not shoot. And they say often ballots and often dollars and ballots have more impact than bombs and bullets. So even from the ground, from the experience in Afghanistan and Iraq, there's a recognition in the military that violence has only limited effectiveness, and that if we are going to have enduring security and real peace, we need to rely primarily on nonviolent means of conflict resolution.
Well, and what would this mean for UUs? Obviously, we don't run governments or armies. Is this something that should be informing, say, the efforts of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee?
Well, I think so. And also, I mean, I would back, I think it reflects very much. One of the members of our core team is Charlie Clements, who is on the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. So there's a recognition that all of that work of addressing basic issues of violations of human rights and economic rights is peacemaking, right, at its best. But also, Unitarian Universalists have run governments, have been presidents. In fact, two of the leading political scientists and thinkers now shaping American defense policy are Unitarian Universalists. Joseph Nye, who's known for his development of the importance of, he calls it soft power as opposed to hard power, the way in which diplomacy and cultural exchanges and educational exchanges can be more effective than military and economic coercion. And William Perry, who was in the Clinton administration, evolved in. So I think we have Unitarians who not only as voters really affect the stance that our government takes, we have Unitarian Universalists who are in government.
That's so
interesting. Are in the military, who I think are going to be making these policies.
Well, let me ask Ira Chernus then, having presented a principled nonviolence perspective for Unitarian Universalists, what do you think about this approach?
I understand that the desire to want to intervene when we see people suffering unjustly is such a powerful desire, and I understand that the first impulse is to want to say, well, let's go in there and just stop the bad guys from doing what they're doing. But this raises such a difficult set of issues because, in the first place, there's the question of whether using violence to stop violence is going to help us get to the stages of peacemaking and peace building. Or might the violence sow the seeds of anger and counter-violence that will actually prevent or make it harder to move on to the stages of peacemaking and peace-building? I think that's a very difficult issue to grapple with. And there's also always the challenge that while this is such an appealing scenario in theory, that we go in, we stop the violence, we work on peacemaking, the we who are going in are always already involved in the conflict that has led to the violence. If we look at any specific situation in the world, these outbreaks of violence in places that seem so distant from us are not actually that distant because of the global interconnections, economic and political and social interconnections. The major powers, and certainly the United States, are already always involved, so that the people who are doing the fighting on the ground will not likely see intervention from outside as disinterested. There's it's as if we're going into a boiling pot thinking that we're going to turn down the heat, but all too often, inadvertently perhaps, unknowingly, we actually turn up the heat. So it raises a very difficult set of questions that I understand are very difficult and troubling to people of goodwill who hold a whole variety of positions on these issues.
Great, and I'm looking forward to a dialogue now between our three expert witnesses on this topic. I'm Kathy Partridge, your host for the Dialogue on War and Peace for Unitarian Universalists, and we are discussing amongst Paul Razor, Director of the Center for the Study of Religious Freedom and Professor of Interdisciplinary Studies at Virginia Wesleyan College, also Meadville Lombard Provost and Professor of Religion and Society, Sharon Welch, and University of Colorado Professor of Religion, Ira Chernus. and want to get back to an interchange on these many, many ideas. As a lay Unitarian Universalist myself, considering the study and action issue, I think that we've raised a lot of issues here and looking forward to some depth and back and forth. Sharon Welch, as a member of the core team working on the study action issue, just remind us again about the issue and how congregations can get involved in this process.
Yes, we're asking congregations to share with each other their best practices for responding to the particular issues of war and peace and violence that we see at multiple levels. We've been speaking in our conversation today primarily about conflict between nations, but we're asking congregations to also be looking at conflicts within nations, within local communities, and within congregations and with families. And so basically it's looking at the whole it's looking at peacemaking from the personal, interpersonal, communal, and social levels.
Well, and since we are hopefully the first in a series of such dialogues talking about war and peace, let me just open the conversation up to the three of you and welcome. You know, we might have a little bit of jostling and interruptions, and that's okay. But to let's talk together about the current situation. We're recording this on the day after the fifth anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. We know that the Unitarian Universalist President Bill Sinkford has all along issued some strong pastoral statements against the war and called on UUs to take action in the month of March around peace. From your various perspectives and overlapping viewpoints on issues of nonviolence, of principled or practical, of peacemaking and peacekeeping, of certain aspects of just war, let's frame the situation today for our UU congregations. What's a way that people can and might be responding? Ira Chernus, you're in the studio with me. I'll turn to you and ask you if you'll start first.
I think we all will agree amongst us, despite our differences, that the various principles that we adhere to would all tell us that the kind of war the United States is waging in Iraq does not meet any of the ethical criteria. The difficult question is, how do we disengage and how do we avoid such problems coming up in the future? Because it's important for us to remember that 5 years ago when this war started, an awful lot of people of moral goodwill supported the idea because there was a terrible dictatorship in Iraq and all sorts of injustices, horrible injustices being perpetrated. So I wonder if rather than asking what the situation is today, if we take ourselves back 5 years and say, how do we deal with the situation where we see people suffering under dictatorships we want to respond, because those kinds of situations certainly still exist today. I wonder what the other folks in the discussion might think about that.
This is Sharon. One of the things I'd like to share, you know, with you is a story. I found it very interesting. I've been a professor for a number of years at the University of Missouri in Columbia, and one of the things I've liked is teaching primarily conservative students. And most of my students have family members in the military. Many of them are going into military service themselves. And before the U.S. invaded Iraq, I asked students to do a study project where they ask members of their family and friends what they thought of as examples of just wars and unjust wars. And it was interesting that every single person thought that the war in Vietnam was unjust. And this was people even whose, you know, of course, fathers had served in that war, but they saw it as being unjust because we were brought into that war under false pretenses, and so they saw it being as an unnecessary loss of life. When the war in Iraq started, I was so surprised that it was so difficult, right, to make the switch from a recognition of the folly of Vietnam to the likely folly of Iraq, and to feel a sense myself of, as a member of the peace movement, as responsibility for that, because while conservative students would really, most of us were opposed to war. They admired our courage, and they saw that we had compassion for soldiers and for the enemies. They really doubted our competence in being able to respond effectively. So when there was a perceived threat, they were responding with the tools that they knew and the tools that they trusted. And so as a professor, I saw the need both to educate more effectively about the very rich heritage that Ira talks about. Throughout history, there have been effective ways in which nonviolence has been used to stop structural violence, and yet very few people know the details of Gandhi's campaign or of Martin Luther King's campaign or the work of Poland and the Solidarity Movement and some of the details of the kind of work that happened in South Africa. So there's a rich legacy. Also, a need to really hone more creatively and carefully our means of, say, with, for example, the International Criminal Court as a means of bringing dictators to justice and realizing that the international community can act in very effective ways. And the last point, in doing all of this, and this alludes to another point that Ira made, quite often the U.S. is most effective when we act in concert with others rather than we act alone, because there is a perception quite often in many parts of the world that when the United States acts, we're not acting in the best interest of other countries, and there's a real suspicion of what the motivations might be. And so the need for genuinely multilateral responses, both when those responses include, say, civilian police forces, as well as when they are completely nonviolent forces, the need for multilateral responses is one that's very crucial in our particular situation.
Paul Razor.
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said. I mean, these are such rich and complex issues that I think we can just kind of highlight a few things. And in the context of, I guess I want to speak to two contexts that have been raised. One is the one we're talking about now, and for example, the intervention or invasion of Iraq. It's been pointed out, I think Ira pointed out, or no, Sharon, or maybe both of you pointed out, that a lot of people supported that at the beginning, although probably far fewer than in certain other cases. I, as a theologian, I'd like to encourage us, UUs, and people who are taking principled stances, either at on that war. I mean, we're way beyond the beginning of that war, but I think it's still worth rearticulating the principles involved, because other situations will come up and, in fact, I think are being planned for and so on. And if we say that it was wrong or improper in some way, Bush didn't make the case, we're implying, if we say something like that, that a case could be made and that we'd know it when we saw it, which implies that we're operating from a set of criteria somewhere. And I think it's very important that we be able to identify and articulate what the basis of our judgments are on cases like that. We might take a principled stance, which I would think would be close to Ira's stance, that say it doesn't matter what the case is, it just cannot be justified either ever or certainly in a circumstance like this. Or if we say the following conditions weren't met, we're sort of saying, but if they were met, then we would support it. And I think it's important to be clear about that. And I'd like to link this to the questions that have been raised about intervention. I liked Sharon's analysis, very helpful way of presenting the question about a duty or responsibility to intervene in certain circumstances. Traditionally, this is often called humanitarian intervention, but what it really means is sort of intervention in the face of humanitarian crises of one kind or another. And I think that that's always been the hardest case for people from both the just war traditions and the pacifist or nonviolence traditions, because in the just war tradition, one of the traditional just causes for responding with military force or violent force was an uninvited border crossing by a foreign army, like an invasion, for example. And when you think about it, if we're proposing that we send the Marines to places to help quell humanitarian violations, human rights violations, in effect, that's an act of war if it's uninvited. I mean, it could be seen as an act of war, certainly in traditional terms. So it's a very tricky proposition to make, and it raises the questions about who gets to decide and who is best placed to intervene once a decision is made, and then when are circumstances bad enough to intervene. I mean, we can point to Rwanda and Darfur, for example, as cases where most people would probably agree, but is the mere existence of a dictator bad enough? How much brutality does there have to be before we send in the troops? I mean, these are horribly complex and difficult questions, but you have to be prepared to answer them, even if in principle intervention is an option. And you also need to have, like, criteria. I mean, for the practical questions that I was raising about whether this works is one set of questions, is a very important question, but there's also the moral questions and the theological questions about, is it right? And you can ask those from both sides. Is it right to intervene? Is it right to avoid intervening when you genuinely feel that some good could be done? So I think these are very complicated questions, and I do think that this particular context of intervention in the face of humanitarian crisis probably puts the questions in their starkest and most difficult context.
One of the things I find so fascinating is there's a study. It's called The Responsibility to Protect, and it was a commission that was formed by the Canadian government, and it was published in 2000. An international commission, and it has 12 members from Australia, Algeria, Canada, South Africa, Philippines, Guatemala, among other countries. And in dealing with these issues, they focus precisely on some of the concerns that Paul, you and Ira have both raised. One is they don't want to even use the term humanitarian intervention because of the assumption that it gives is that the intervention is going to be justifiable. They want it to be a very high bar, right, in a really rigorous period of examination before there is any kind of intervention. And a sense in realizing that while motives will always be mixed, to make sure that the motives are one that can pass the muster of an international community, so rather than just a small body of states, because realizing that the history, we don't want to have a kind of intervention is not a good one. Also, they raise as well, and this is the thing that you were saying, Ira, is that facing the fact that a lot of these conflicts in which Western nations are contemplating stepping in, we were part of causing the problem in the first place.
Right.
And so what does it mean to have an intervention that includes this really honest taking stock of our history? Mark Morrison Reed, who is a Unitarian Universalist minister, spoke in my class a couple of weeks ago. I'm teaching a course at Meadville-Lombard on strategic peace building. And he talked about the importance of national holidays and rituals, where not only do we have something like, Veterans Day, Memorial Day, where we honor those who were killed in wars, but what it might be like to have days in which we actually honor those whose deaths we have caused through unnecessary violence. And so he talks about the needs of rituals of recognition and acknowledgement and contrition. And that has to be there, I think, as a chastening dimension of any contemplation of the responsibility to protect.
I think this is one of the strengths of the nonviolence tradition, is precisely because it begins from the premise that we are all already always interconnected, that we are never outsiders intervening in some situation that somehow we've not been part of creating, but in fact we were always already there. It forces us to accept that kind of responsibility. And by taking away the option of violence, I think it forces us much more to focus on what we can do to prevent the future atrocities that are now brewing because our government, allied governments, various centers of power are already contributing to that growth and that development. If you look at the case of Iraq, obviously you can look back and see a whole history of the United States and Britain and the other colonial powers having been involved in the circumstances that created Saddam Hussein and his ability to perpetrate such atrocities as he did. So I always think there's something a bit unrealistic in these scenarios of intervention, whether you either call them humanitarian or whatever, because they always sort of assume that we weren't involved in this, these bad guys have done these bad things, and now we're going to go in there and use our guns and bombs to stop them. And to me, that's not only a recipe for perpetuating the violence in that particular situation, but it also it discourages us from looking at the crucial situations brewing today that are going to breed the injustices and violence of the future.
Yeah, this is Paul. I want to comment on Sharon's point that Mark Morrison Reed made. That I think is a wonderful thing that we need to be addressing, both as a movement and certainly a larger scale in this country, the question of whether it's rituals or holidays or some way to publicly acknowledge our own role in creating victims and in causing these kinds of situations. And it goes as well as to the practical question about, you know, he was our dictator and now we're going to take him down kind of thing. But on a much larger scale, because I think it's natural that you respond with what's most familiar. And in our history, in our national history, the most familiar has been the military. And we've celebrated violence and celebrated the military, and we have holidays, and we brag about, you know, we're the biggest army and we're the toughest and all that kind of stuff. And it comes into the national psyche in a way that's very difficult to I don't want to say work against, but to have alternatives that aren't perceived as you know, disrespecting the service that people have done in the military in the past and so on. And it's a very tricky thing, and it's comparable in my mind to the whole question of you have to educate people in the ways of nonviolent conflict resolution, for example, and make it actually available in practice and then kind of theoretically available within people's minds as something they would turn to. And this is kind of a larger scale of that sort of thing. It's part of bringing the public mind around the notion that there are other ways to think about this than simply violence and the military.
I'd like to ask Paul and Sharon, though, whether you think there might be a danger here. It's so tempting, I think, to say, well, we're going to, in essence, confess our sins. We're going to really commemorate all the times we got it wrong, and that's going to help us get it right the next time. You know, I think that's what President Bush told us about Iraq. He said, well, you know, maybe in Vietnam we got it wrong. Maybe there were times in the past we got it wrong. But recognizing that helps us to be so much more careful, and we're going to get it right this time. We're really only going to intervene when it's really justified. So I wonder whether there's a danger that we go through this sort of purification ritual, as it were, that gives us a kind of cleans the slate of our conscience and makes it perhaps even easier to intervene the next time and then have to go through the same ritual of confessing that we got it wrong again. I wonder where that cycle stops.
Well, one of the things I think is interesting is to look at, I think you're very right to point out that danger, and it's happened. And I think there's also a danger on the other side. When we think of the 800,000 who were killed in Rwanda, and we look at the 250,000 who've been killed and hundreds of thousands displaced in Darfur, and the deaths in Iraq, and realizing that those of us, you know, who tend to be more on the side of nonviolence also don't have clean hands if we haven't developed the sort of effective responses. I have such respect, for example, for the Christian peacemaker teams who actually put themselves in situations of violence. And I just had people in my class who were speaking, who have been in Colombia and standing there with people who are organizing, you know, peasants and labor organizers, and they were standing there to not only be a witness, but to be a nonviolent barrier to the acts of violence. And so, like Gandhi, putting your body actually on the line. Also, I see, and this is a very practical task, that in some ways what the best thinking is doing in the regard of the responsibility to protect is trying to apply what we've learned about policing nationally to policing internationally, which is a move away from vigilantism is the rule of law and the limited rule of force. And the best police forces are also carefully monitored by the community. As Iris pointed out so rightly, that the violence can so quickly spiral out of hand, and we've seen where it happens. I mean, it becomes as destabilizing as the criminal activity it means to contain. But the idea in which we see in our local communities a modicum of force carefully and continuously monitored can enable a community to find nonviolent ways of responding to its conflicts. And so I see the challenges before us really as ones of finding the practical expressions of ways of resolving these very grave threats.
I think it's very good to point out that there are so many cases of nonviolent intervention. And, of course, Gandhi had developed very elaborate plans for a nonviolent army, a highly disciplined army. Now, imagine if the United States, instead of spending our $600 or $700 billion a year on a violent army, imagine if we spent half that, a tenth of that, on training and equipping a nonviolent army. We could make an enormous difference in the world. But still, if we wait until these situations reach those crisis proportions and then decide that's the time to intervene, it's far too late. The real time to intervene, and I agree with Sharon that the peace movement did not do nearly enough in the kinds of cases, the Rwanda, Darfur, the cases that are so famous, the real times to intervene are the times when our own government, our own corporations, our own financial community is sowing the seeds of future violence, and the nonviolence tradition gives us an enormous array of tools, weapons, if you like, to make those kinds of interventions, because it's really, again, all about justice and equity, and we have to be looking ahead to see, because the violence really begins years, even decades, before it breaks out physically, and the nonviolence movement, I think, is by far best equipped to make that kind of intervention, to make which makes the intervention with the guns and the bombs unnecessary.
Yeah, this is Paul. I think Ira is right to point out the some of the dangers of all of these proposals, and then certainly any of them can be manipulated, as the just war tradition has often been manipulated and used in ways that are from my perspective inappropriate to the tradition, and I mean, cynics would have a field day with the idea of we'll all forgive ourselves and then, you know, go and do it again and forgive ourselves again and that sort of thing, and that's a danger to watch out for. And I'm love the idea, fully support the idea of nonviolent interventions of the type that both Ira and Sharon have been talking about. Whether we do it on a formal basis of, you know, Gandhi's nonviolent army, I mean, the idea of having a national peace force at the command of the president, for example, is a very different thing than the Christian peacemakers teams. But if it could be pulled off, or if we could somehow sow the seeds in society so that people would understand and see that as a real option, I think that would be of enormous value. And I don't want to get too personal in this, but I've lived through some of these things myself. I have actually been part of accompaniment teams and witness teams in El Salvador during the wars in the 1980s, where in many situations, and I didn't even go in with this purpose, or at least not exclusively with this kind of purpose, but where my mere presence at an episode stopped the death squads or stopped the military from coming in and killing several people, not mine alone. There were other people, but I think that on a massive scale, this could be a wonderfully effective tool. And I think that part of our educational responsibility might be to help the public at large, help members of our denomination and so on, see how many of whom already know, see how these things actually do work and have worked in the past, and to continue to try to make this part of our religious education curriculum and in other ways make people aware of these possibilities. The idea of was it Ron Sider who made this radical, was perceived as radical proposal maybe a decade ago now, about we need to be prepared to die by the thousands and to go, you know, by the thousands to places like Rwanda. And the idea was, you know, we have military people who arguably are willing to die for their country, certainly willing to kill for their country at the command of the president, and the proposal was that if we're that willing, we ought to be able to do this in a peaceful way as well. It's a very powerful moral challenge, I think.
A powerful challenge indeed. And I want to thank the three of you, Paul Razor, Sharon Welch, and Ira Chernus, for raising so many issues for our UU congregations to consider as they are exploring the study action issue. Let's give each of you just a final minute or so to a quick wrap-up or parting thought, and then some contact information. Ira, let's start with you. Final thoughts.
Throughout this discussion, I've been thinking about the role of religious communities in promoting ideals. Yes, we always have to hold those ideals in tension with the reality of today, but I think the religious communities have a special responsibility to envision how life could be lived in the future. And my fear is that any of these proposals that would legitimate violence in any sense are in some ways unrealistic, because the reality is that these are always implemented by governments which are self-interested, which already have an interest in the conflict area. And so if we're thinking from the point of view of ideals in tension with reality, I think we have to recognize that the kinds of ideals that would open a way for violence are always going to be perverted and distorted by the reality of governments implementing them, whereas nonviolence gives us an opportunity to pursue an ideal that is, it's much harder for it to be tainted by the self-interest of governments and other parties.
Paul Razor?
Yeah, I want to just come back to the study action issue. And I think the final point I want to make about that is that whatever position we end up taking, however we come out on these issues as a denomination, or I suppose even as individuals, I think that it's important that we be, number one, as clear as possible, and number two, that we be able to articulate the theological reasons for the positions that we take. In other words, we should be able to point to what is UU-ish about the stance that we take, and maybe make sure we connect it to our own religious values. We sometimes get in the habit of adopting statements that don't refer to any theological values, and I think it's especially in a case like this that we be very clear about this, and also about what the purpose of this kind of a statement is. I mean, Ira's point about policies are implemented by governments is a very good one, and I think we need to be very clear, and from my perspective, that the study action issue is inviting us not to make a statement as though we were a recommendation to the president, but rather as a basis for our own response to our government's actions and so on, and that we, regardless of how we would act if we were king or if we were president, that what we're really articulating here is a moral theological statement of our own, a declaration of our own values, and that can be used as a guidance for advocacy, for statements we might make in prophetic critique, for individuals who are struggling with this as matters of conscience, and so on. So I think that sort of clarity is really important as we move forward with this process.
Sharon Welch?
Yes, I think one of the things that's interesting, and I think it would be fascinating to continue this conversation and looking at these political questions from the theological lens. And one of the things that I see as a kind of particular way in which Unitarian Universalists have tended to understand ourselves is, for example, in contrast to the well-known Quaker statement of speaking truth to power, quite often we have seen ourselves as the ones who are in power to a varying degree, and so it's a sense of what do you do once you're spoken to? How do we use power truthfully? We have members of our denomination who are advisors to presidents, who are in Congress, who are leaders in the military, and are leaders in businesses and schools. And so how do we use our power, and again, this is a thread that's come through all of this, to really build peace over the long haul, and that what we're looking at is not merely a reaction to war, but is rather building institutions that enable people to live with justice and equity and compassion. And that is our calling, and that is our responsibility.
And Sharon Welch, how can our listeners find out more about the study action issue?
On the UUA website, it's possible to find the resources from the Committee on Social Witness, and you will find there a host of resources, particular resources for religious education, so from children through adults. There's a resource guide, an annotated bibliography of sources. You could also join a listserv of congregations that are sharing the work that they're doing to embody peacemaking in their congregations.
And that's at www.uua.org. You've been listening to the Dialogue on War and Peace for Unitarian Universalists with Paul Raiser, UU theologian and director of the Center for the Study of Religious Freedom at Virginia Wesleyan College, Ira Chernus, Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Colorado, and Meadville Lumbar Provost and Professor of Religion and Society, Sharon Welch. Thank you for listening, and good deliberations as you consider your own Dialogue on War and Peace. I've been your host, Kathy Partridge. Again, for more information, please contact www.uua.org.